I'm Aaron Ross Powell, and this is Reimagining Liberty, a podcast exploring the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic freedom. Few terms in our contemporary political scene provoke stronger reactions than critical race theory. If you listen to much of the right, CRT is a Marxist plot to literally destroy America by teaching children to hate the country, its founding principles, and even themselves. The resulting moral panic has led to anti-CRT legislation and acted as a precursor to the growing anti-trans and anti-gay backlash among reactionary conservatives. But what is critical race theory? Because few of those people with strong opinions seem to have much of an idea. Today, I'm talking with Sam Hoadley Brill, a PhD student in philosophy and a fellow at the African American Policy Forum. Sam has written extensively about critical race theory, the movement against it on the right, and the way concerns are being manipulated by dishonest activists like Christopher Rufo to roll back the achievements of social liberalism. Before we get to the current moral panic about critical race theory, let's start by clearing up for people just what it is, and I think just as importantly, what it isn't. Because like Marxism and postmodernism, a lot of right-wingers are against it without, it often seems, having much of a sense of what it actually is. So to the extent that we can briefly summarize an entire academic subdiscipline, what is critical race theory?
So the term critical race theory was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw. She's a law professor and executive director of the African American Policy Forum, which I currently work at. And when she coined the term critical race theory, or CRT as it's often referred to, that referred to a very niche at the time intellectual movement in the legal academy, in law schools, and in works in law journals. But it has since become influential in many other disciplines outside of law, disciplines in the humanities and social sciences like philosophy, education, and sociology, and so on. So for a brief definition, I would say that critical race theory is a practice of examining the role of race and racism in society, the social construction of race and institutionalized racism, and how race intersects with identity, systems, and policies. Now, that seems like a very, you know, concise definition. Ironically, that definition actually comes from a proposed bill written by a Republican in Minnesota to actually ban public schools from having any instruction required that related to critical race theory on that definition. So that proposal would have banned schools from requiring any instruction that examines the role of race and racism in society, the social construction of race, institutionalized racism, or how race intersects with identity, systems, and policies. Now, usually the people who are opposed to critical race theory aren't so accurate when defining it. So that is a bit of an outlier in terms of the right-wing legislation proposed to ban critical race theory. The people who oppose CRT will usually define it by demonizing it, as you said, a lot like the right-wing proposed definitions of postmodernism and caricatures of Marxism. And CRT, the preferred way of demonizing it, has typically been to connect it to Marxism. So James Lindsay is one of the most prominent influencers in right-wing misinformation, disinformation about what critical race theory is in the moral panic. And he wrote an entire book called Race Marxism that was supposed to reveal the hidden truth about critical race theory. Christopher Rufo is perhaps the most publicly prominent influencer in the CRT moral panic. And he has said many times that he takes most of his understanding of critical race theory from James Lindsay. They both like to refer to it as either race-based Marxism or race Marxism. And in some cases, they refer to it as state-sanctioned racism. They argue that critical race theory sees all white people as oppressors and all people of color as victims, and that critical race theory thinks white people should feel guilty or ashamed for being white. And that kind of language has been very prominent in the bills going around red states that are supposed to ban critical race theory. They say that teachers cannot promote any material that says that any student should feel ashamed or any kind of psychological distress on account of their race. And that language actually comes originally from Donald Trump's executive order in September 2020, which was aimed at banning racial diversity training and federal government trainings, and it targeted critical race theory by name. Of course, critical race theory does not actually say that all white people are oppressors, that white children should feel guilty for their race. Ironically, it's pretty much the exact opposite. It's much more focused on institutions and the role that institutions and policies and social systems and structures have in upholding racism, and very much not excessively concerned with the psychological life of the individual racist.
That seems like a distinction worth taking a moment to dig into, because I think it is central to a lot of both the moral panic and the dishonesty that you see in the way that the right talks about this, but also a lot of the confusion that people who maybe aren't coming to it from a dishonest place, but are genuinely just confused about this. And that's the nature of racism within this context. So, for example, take like systemic racism is something that gets talked about and is, as it's used by CRT scholars and people in adjacent fields, it seems to be fairly straightforward, but it does get at that difference between saying you, specific person, are a racist, whether knowingly or unknowingly, or all whites are racists, and institutions can be racist. Those mean different things. So what is the difference in, I guess, the application of the term racism in those two contexts?
Yeah. So this is, of course, a matter of debate in anti-racist scholarship, and not all critical race theorists agree, and not all, anti-racist scholars agree about how to define racism, how to define institutionalized racism. Systemic racism is one that started out with a pretty specific meaning proposed, I believe, by the sociologist Joe Feagin, but has come to be used much more broadly, much like the term critical race theory itself, much like terms like intersectionality. These ideas can often take on a sort of life of their own when they are divorced from the academic context in which they were originally proposed. In terms of what I think, as a critical philosopher of race, I would characterize myself. I've studied mostly the work of Charles Mills, who is a professor of mine, very unfortunately passed away a little over a year ago now. But I think that his work is severely underappreciated and has very rich intellectual contributions to a lot of these kinds of debates. So pulling a passage from him here, this is from his book, Black Rights, White Wrongs. And he writes that racism has been given various competing definitions and attributed competing areas of application. I would distinguish between racism in the ideational sense, a complex of ideas, beliefs, values, and racism in the socio-institutional sense, institutions, practices, social systems. For the first sense, the ideational sense, I would favor this definition. Racism is the belief that humanity can be divided into discrete races, and these races are hierarchically arranged, with some races superior to others. The second sense, the socio-institutional sense, would then refer to institutions, practices, and social systems that illicitly privilege some races at the expense of others, where racial membership, directly or indirectly, explains this privileging. So I think that gets at the core issue pretty well. and it helps us understand what is the key value of drawing a conceptual distinction between the racism that exists on an interpersonal level or even intrapersonal, right? Just some individual racists' beliefs about racial superiority and inferiority, and also the kinds of practices that can perpetuate racial inequality, even if there aren't necessarily any individual racists who are participating in them. For instance, some policy like stop and frisk, or, you know, there are countless police examples to go on, or other things in terms of redlining and housing discrimination. There, the person who is discriminating against someone might not actually believe that races are inferior or superior, but the way that the practices are carried out can end up having the same effects as if those people did have those beliefs.
I can imagine some of my friends on the right listening to this right now, though, and saying, are you then saying that racism in this systemic institutional sense is always present whenever there are racially disparate outcomes? And if so, does that basically mean that we have to assume that races, which often map onto ethnic groups or cultural groups for, you know, a variety of reasons, are in their behaviors, preferences, tastes, and so on, all identical, right? So like that if it turns out that a certain group that happens to share a skin color but also a culture has different outcomes than a different group with a skin color and a culture, that is evidence of racism, as opposed to just any two groups are going to have differences between them that they're then going to manifest in outcomes however we measure those.
Yeah, so great question. I actually think this is a good objection to certain brands of anti-racism. For instance, as far as I can tell, the anti-racism of a scholar like Ibram Kendi, I read his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, in the summer of 2020, and I found it severely disappointing in terms of its relative status in that cultural moment. You know, it was atop the New York Times bestsellers list. People were including it on all sorts of anti-racist reading lists. And as far as I can tell, Kendi actually does believe that any racial disparity is always and only explained by racism. It's actually a bit more accurate to put it as though racism just is the disparities between races, and that, you know, any explanation must pretty much be monocausal and cannot account for any other influences. Now, I think that's wrong. I gave a talk at the American Philosophical Association meeting in January 2021, where I delivered a critique of Robin DiAngelo and Ibram Kendi, and didn't have much time to go into detail. But the main objection that I gave to Kendi's theory was exactly the sort of one you're posing, where, for instance, if we look at the undergraduate population of Ivy League schools and see how many students are Jewish, then we compare that to the number of Americans overall who are Jewish. Number of Americans overall is something around 2%. The number of undergraduates at Ivy Leagues is something like 14%. And so, according to Kendi's theory, which also goes into detail about what he calls ethnic racism, where he makes exactly the point you were sort of challenging me with, which is he argues that actually any kind of disparity between racialized ethnic groups, which Jews are probably the paramount example of a racialized ethnic group, that those disparities are explained by racism, that any policy that produces such disparities is a racist policy. And that to me sounds sort of akin to kind of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories that actually led to implementing quotas on how many Jewish students could enroll at Ivy League universities earlier in the 20th century. So I think that there's nothing in critical race theory that commits you to that position. And Ibram Kendi himself has said that while he's inspired by critical race theorists, he doesn't consider himself to be one.
I think that just is that's an important point to make, because
yeah,
it's frustrating how many people are, they're like, I don't like critical race theory, and the only thing I've read is Kindi.
Exactly.
So on the flip side of it then, or I guess not necessarily the flip side, but just from the other direction, one of the other criticisms that gets leveled against CRT, either as it actually exists or as it exists in kind of the fever dreams of Glenn Beck and so on, is that it is fundamentally a form of anti-white racism. Mm-hmm. That this is a, whatever value these theories have or whatever their arguments, they're ultimately motivated by a hatred of white people or whiteness or a wanting to tear down the status of whites or whatever. And I mean, just, is it yesterday? Tulsi Gabbard, who, it's hard to pull out a coherent ideology from what seems to be just like a grab bag of like nonsense and conspiracy thinking on her part. But Tulsi Gabbard listed anti-white racism that she said was endemic in the mainstream Democratic Party as a reason that she was leaving that party. Which is a little bit perplexing because I don't see a lot of anti-white racism from Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi. But what is the role of anti-white racism in all of this?
Yeah, so anti-white racism is frequently invoked when it comes to any kind of white backlash, what Martin Luther King Jr. called a white backlash. And Black intellectuals from Frederick Douglass to Martin Luther King and beyond have pointed out this phenomenon in American politics, that basically whenever there is substantive progress made for Black Americans, especially, but also for people of color generally, whenever some progress is made, it is immediately responded to with an assertion of white supremacy, right? And this, I'm not, when I say white backlash, I don't mean that every white person responds negatively. Of course, we know that most white people would declare themselves not racist. Maybe not most would say that they're anti-racist, although I think probably most would say that they're anti-racist, but that term has become kind of toxic to some because of things like the CRT moral panic. But we know that most white people in the U.S. do not think of themselves as racists anymore. But when the status quo of white people being superior to Black people in the social and political realms is challenged, that is fought with, again, what King called a white backlash. And so one of the most common ways that the fight begins is by asserting that progress for Black people is necessarily oppression of white people, that anti-racism, giving Black people rights, must be taking away white people's rights. And you see this, it's interesting how the politics of the Republican Party have shifted, because when David Duke ran and won a seat in the, I believe, the state Senate of Louisiana, it was the state government of Louisiana in 1991. It was 1989 or 1991. He ran several times, but he ran as a Republican, and he was elected as a Republican. And President George Bush, George H.W. Bush, got involved and was like, the Republican Party does not support this. And the fundamental talking points of David Duke, who at that time had abandoned the Klan imagery, you know, he claimed to have denounced the Ku Klux Klan, and he started his NAAWP, the National Association for Advancement of White People. But all of his rhetoric and talking points were about how affirmative action is racism toward white people, how any kind of substantive program to give positive benefits to Black people was anti-white fundamentally in nature. And the Republican Party then saw this as dangerous and that it had to be denounced. And since, the Republican Party has pretty much wholeheartedly endorsed this, that, you know, race, that affirmative action, that, you know, say if you have two equally qualified candidates for a job or a spot at a university, and one is white, the other is Black, that you can take that into account and give this token form of benefit to the black person in that case, well, that's fundamentally anti-white. Critical race theory, many critical race theorists do support affirmative action. Not all do, interestingly, especially because now the only kind of affirmative action that exists is that which uses diversity as its rationale. Schools are not allowed to implement an affirmative action plan with reparations as rationale. The only rationale that's accepted by the Supreme Court is diversity, and who knows how long it'll last, because I think affirmative action is on the docket in October. But it's been very interesting to see the anti-CRT moral panic, with especially people like Christopher Rufo taking up the exact talking points of people who just, you know, 30 years ago were seen as a threat to the image of the Republican Party. And now the talking points are fundamentally indistinguishable.
Let's turn to the moral panic then, away from defining our terms and our disciplines, to the contemporary scene. CRT's been around for decades as a somewhat obscure field of legal theory, certainly obscure by the standards of most Americans. Were not aware of it. And you don't get it. I went to law school and I don't remember being explicitly taught CRT stuff. And I took a legal theory course. But so what's happening now? Like, why now is this the panic? And I guess one way to frame the question is, there have always been moral panics on the right that are typically, we just don't like that the social liberals are pushing a socially liberalizing agenda of acceptance for groups that we think should be less privileged or should be excluded or should be discriminated against, or just, you know, are run counter to socially conservative values. And there's always something that they point to. So there was Sharia law was it for a while. And that just basically meant anything that the people who give acceptance speeches at the Academy Awards would support was basically Sharia law. Or it was postmodernism for a while, or it was Marxism for a while. So is the CRT panic just the latest iteration of that, of grabbing a term that sounds scary to middle Americans, and saying all the stuff that we've always been against happens to be this thing? Or is there something deeper, particularly about, you know, because Sharia law had a racial element because it was fear of Muslims, but it wasn't explicitly about race. Neither was postmodernism, neither was Marxism, but this one is. So is there something else going on right now that makes it, that racializes things?
That's a good question. I think that there are two things going on. One of them is the white backlash dynamic that I just referred to a bit ago. And the other is the need for moral panics that do not necessarily need to be racialized, but need to be oriented around some sense of what it is to be an American, around American identity. And this is important for the Republican Party, because for a long time now, the Republican Party has been a very nationalist party. So the Sharia law thing worked especially well, I think, in the aftermath of 9/11. You see Islam as a threat to American identity, because you can point to the visceral image of, the Twin Towers being assaulted by aircraft and the people who died and all of the sweeping policies that were enacted afterwards, right? So there needs to be some kind of binding myth that brings people together that they can point to in the event that there are serious questions asked about, well, what does the Republican Party actually even stand for, right? Because we know that the material economic policies that the Republican Party stands for are overwhelmingly unpopular. People are not very happy about more tax cuts for the rich and more taxes that they themselves have to pay. These things are not going to win elections. So Republicans have to run on another platform. And they often do, using bigoted social rhetoric that often falls under the label of culture wars, which I'm not, I didn't see a problem with it in the past, but the more I've come to think about that frame, culture wars, the more I've come to think that it's actually counterproductive and just sort of seeds ground to the right. But that's that's another conversation entirely. But these sorts of things, I mean, just before Fox News picked up critical race theory as the new moral panic, they were talking about Dr. Seuss's books being banned. Banned as in they were out of print. But, you know, the truth doesn't matter in a moral panic. It's about taking, you know, some isolated event, ramping it up as, portraying it as a threat to civilization and self-identity and everything that we've always cared about, our way of life. And that's what it did with critical race theory. Just before critical race theory, I can't remember whether it was before or after the Dr. Seuss panic, they were talking about Mr. Potato Head's gender being changed. So often these things are thrown at the wall. You know, they throw whatever it is at the wall, they see what sticks. Critical race theory stuck. And I think that the main reason it stuck is going back to the other phenomenon, the white backlash. So this began really in 2020 with the first piece of official policy was Donald Trump's executive order targeting critical race theory by name. He called it a Marxist doctrine. He called it toxic, that it was poisoning the minds of American children. And why September 2020? Well, because after George Floyd was murdered by the police in May 2020, we witnessed the most massive and most racially diverse protests for racial justice in American history. And for the first time, it seemed like it wasn't just a matter of mostly Black people fighting for their rights, but for a truly multiracial coalition that was going to strive towards a multiracial democracy. And in the 60s, those protests then were more diverse than the previous wave of protests that swept the nation, but nothing like the ones that we saw in 2020. And so this white backlash has to, you know, there has to be one. The pendulum swings one way and it always swings back the other way. And I think you can really see that backlash start to take root in, for instance, Tucker Carlson's coverage of the Black Lives Matter protests that summer. He started to break records of how many sets of eyeballs were glued to him as he demonized Black people fighting for their rights and against police brutality. He was saying that they were coming for you. And we know Fox's broadcast, I think their viewership is something like 96% white. So, you know, the context is very implicit throughout all that. And then I think the first big moment of self-assertion of the white backlash on a large scale was January 6th, 2021. There was research by the political scientist Robert Pape, who found that what all of these insurrectionists had in common wasn't that they all came from red states or anything like that. But what was true was that they all came from places where non-white populations were growing fastest. So there are many other things going on at the same time. Of course, you can't reduce it to any one cause, but I think that the unification of the white backlash and your typical Republican pushed Fox News, you know, right-wing media pushed moral panic converged and found very fertile ground in 2021, especially.
I wonder too if there's just, I think one of the things that we often forget is how the height of Jim Crow and the civil rights movement and the really ugly open racism throughout, particularly the American South, was not that long ago. Was, you know, like Martin Luther King's his I Have a Dream speech was 59 years ago, I think. So there are people alive today who were teenagers at a time when like really virulent open racism was the norm in their communities, and people don't change that rapidly. You know, I mean, I think the same thing goes on with acceptance of gays and lesbians.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like I was a teenager in the 90s, and it's shocking looking back at how homophobic like mass media was when I was in high school. And that you mentioned Tucker Carlson, the average age of a Tucker Carlson viewer or of a Fox News viewer is well north of 60, I believe. And so how much of this is just people who grew up in a time when it was much more acceptable to be racist, when those hierarchies of races, right? The sense of hierarchies of races was much more ingrained. And so they look around and they see protests, even if they're mostly peaceful, you can find the examples of the violence, and then Tucker can highlight those. And they just view it as these people who I am convinced are somewhat violent by nature anyway, and are, you know, used to be kind of in their place, are now rising up in this violent way, and that's terrifying to me. And it does seem like then the Republican Party and Trump and Chris Rufo and the whole kind of grifting class have just latched on to those, what I think are the racism defined two ways that we talked about earlier. This is like the actual racism of like beliefs and assessments of people as individuals and as members of categories. And so it is, it shouldn't shock us, but it is shocking just how kind of openly racist a lot of the rhetoric is.
Yeah. And I think it's, there's another quote from Martin Luther King that I like to illustrate critical race theory when people ask me more about the details of critical race theory. Like, well, they'll say, you know, well, I get that it's examining, you know, the relationship between race and law and power in American society, but like, what do critical race theorists actually believe? And when I do get into those conversations, I like to throw at them quotes from Martin Luther King that they have likely never heard of, because so many Americans just have this extraordinarily impoverished conception of who Martin Luther King was and what he believed about racism in the U.S. and how to fight it. They think that, you know, he advocated for colorblindness in the sense of having completely race neutral policies, and that would somehow.
But there's that one line. It's the only line anyone knows from anything he ever said.
Exactly. And even that line, when you examine it just a little more closely, doesn't support what they usually think, what they usually take it to support, because what he says is that he has a dream that one day his children, you know, will be able to hold hands with white children, and that people will be judged not for the color of their skin, but for the content of their character. And as far as I can tell, no critical race theorists disagrees with him that is a worthy goal, right? We all want to live in a world, except for the you know, virulent racists of the world. We all want to live in a world where racism is no longer an issue. But you cannot extract from that quote the idea that the means to such an end is to pretend that, you know, race has no relevance and should not be accounted for when it comes to society. I mean, there are quotes where he quite explicitly says that, you know, America has done something special against black people for so long, and so to bring them back up, they need to do something special for them. That's quite explicitly, you know, advocating for race-conscious reparations policies. But the quote that I was thinking of specifically in terms of I was reminded of it by what you were just saying about, we have to remember this wasn't that long ago that, you know, the dogs were sicked on racial justice, civil rights protesters, that people were jailed for these things, that John Lewis's head was beat in for peacefully protesting by police officers in the South. All of these things were not that long ago. And one of the key insights of critical race theory is that racism is not an aberration in America. Racism happens all the time. And this is something that's explicitly been banned in Texas and in Florida. There's legislation that prohibits teachers from describing racism and slavery as anything other than aberrations from or deviations from the core founding principles of America. And that ideology is something that they want their children to learn, that actually, yeah, no, America has always been the land of the free, home of the brave, and with liberty and justice for all. When, of course, anyone who has pretty much any understanding of American history as it relates to the, you know, ideas about race knows that for quite a long time, white supremacy was enshrined explicitly into law. But anyways, the King quote is, and this is something you could read, you know, it sounds exactly like something you would read from a critical race theorist today, is that for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality, while racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists. And the opposite of that is pretty much exactly what Republicans are fighting to put into the head of young children who are going to school in the coming generation.
Let's talk a bit about what it is that they're objecting to being taught, because we are seeing these anti-CRT bills being passed. The real focal point of a lot of their moral panic is the schools, and you know, the worst outbursts always show up at the school board meetings that get filmed and shared. And we've talked about what CRT is, but a lot of what they're objecting to being taught is not actually like the weird little subdiscipline of critical race theory. And I want to mention something that you said on Twitter a while back. And I'm going to encourage, I'll put a link in the show notes, I'm going to encourage listeners to follow you on Twitter because I think you use the medium well.
Well, thank you.
a lot of us would crack that, you know, that the Republicans are upset that CRT is being taught in our elementary schools, but no elementary school is teaching Kimberly Crenshaw. And I have made that remark in the past, and you You've pushed back on that in a way that really stuck with me, saying that to make that argument seeds ground, because that's not what this is really about, and that's not what the "don't teach this stuff in the schools" case made by the right is about. So can you unpack that a little bit?
Sure. There are a few reasons that I think that this is counterproductive, although I have sympathy for people who say it. I was one of these people myself at the very beginning of this whole moral panic, before I think I even really registered it as a moral panic. I thought what was going on was that people had legitimate issues with the ideas that were properly known as critical race theory, and that they wanted to have a kind of public debate about critical race theory. But it has come to my attention, and hopefully everyone else's attention, people, at least anyone who thinks of themselves as, you know, moderately well-informed on this issue, that these people are not interested. The anti-CRT crowd, the people pushing the moral panic, are not interested in having a debate about the pros and cons of the scholarship of critical race theory. One key tweet or pair of tweets in helping me realize this comes from Christopher Rufo himself. He has this habit of sort of tweeting as though he's a kind of cartoon villain announcing his evil plans to the public. So in March 2021, Rufo wrote, "We have successfully frozen their brand, critical race theory, into the public conversation and are steadily driving up negative perceptions. We will eventually turn it toxic as we put all of the various cultural insanities under that brand category. The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. We have decodified the term and will recodify it to annex the entire range of cultural constructions that are unpopular with Americans. So this is a very shameless announcement, almost proud announcement of what the strategy is for the sort of right-wing influencers like Chris Rufo and James Lindsay is, I think, his chief sort of, it's almost wrong to call him a sidekick, because in many ways, James is like the master behind the curtain who is pulling certain strings because of how much Chris Rufo has learned from James Lindsay. But it's clear, it's about branding. So when anyone who has an issue with critical race theory says that, you know, we don't want critical race theory taught in our schools, if you respond to them by saying critical race theory is not actually being taught in our schools, right? There are a couple of problems with that response. First of all, what they mean by critical race theory is likely not the same thing as what you mean by critical race theory. Because when you say that critical race theory is not being taught in schools, that's only true if you have in mind the very narrow conception of what critical race theory is. It's this academic construct. It doesn't influence K-12 curricula, et cetera, et cetera. And what they mean is obviously not that. So one, it creates an issue of talking past one another. Two, also it helps, it just feeds the right-wing narrative that, you know, the left, liberals, the Democratic Party, whatever, however they characterize us, that we are out-of-touch elites who don't care about the concerns of average, ordinary, everyday, working Americans, right? Because if we say, guys, critical race theory is not actually taught in schools, we sound like we're self-congratulatory because we know this thing about an academic elite concept that other people don't know about. So those are a few of the reasons. Another one is just saying, if you respond to someone who says, we don't want critical race theory in schools, by saying, well, don't freak out, it's not in schools, that implies critical race theory is bad and it makes sense for you to not want it in schools, right? Because if somebody said they're teaching algebra in schools and we said, no, they're not teaching algebra in schools, why are you freaking out? Obviously, you can see that that's strange, because the appropriate response is, what's wrong with teaching algebra in schools? Don't you want your kids to know algebra? Don't you want students who can do advanced mathematics? Similarly, we should want critical race theory in schools, insofar as the core ideas are packaged in ways that can be understood by students at whatever age or grade level that they're being taught that. You know, critical race theory, the core insights are just that, look, passing the Civil Rights Acts and the landmark legislation, things like the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, these were important steps in the fight for racial justice. But we cannot say that because our laws are now colorblind or race neutral on paper, that that has eliminated systemic racism or institutionalized racism in the U.S., right? There is a lot more that we have to look at. And so, responding, critical race theory is not being taught, for many reasons, I find is not the right response.
It's interesting and discouraging just how much of this is, you read the tweets from Rufo, is like explicitly a con upon the people that they are riling up, that they are open about lying to their audience in order to get them upset and then to motivate them in directions that Rufo and his compatriots want. And you have, and I'll link to it, a long article you wrote going through just how much Chris Rufo dissembles or misrepresents or outright lies in the stuff that he's doing, and he's open about it. And it reminds me of that there seems like there's been a general shift on the right in being more open about approaching politics in this direction. And so,
yes,
for example, Sarab Amari, in his famous Against David Frenchism article in First Things, I think it was back in May of 2019, which was the essay about Drag Queen Story Hour. For listeners who aren't familiar with it, he says, I pulled it up, he says, and this sounds very much like what you just were describing Rufo saying, he says, quote, progressives understand that culture war means discrediting their opponents and weakening or destroying their institutions. Conservatives should approach the culture war with a similar realism. Civility and decency are secondary values. That this is, it's a very Carl Schmitt view of politics as simply war and rewarding our friends and punishing our enemies. This is just kind of out in the open. And that it's out in the open that this is what the right is doing is one thing. But what's really distressing about this is how many people don't seem to recognize that that's what's happening and just kind of take at face value people like James Lindsay. You know, I know a lot of very smart people in my libertarian circles who were reading Lindsay's books as a way to understand this stuff. And it was like understand critical theory in general, which was very discouraging because he was obviously just a kind of deranged grifter. But accepting Chris Rufo, accepting Sarab Amari, and it feels like those people ought to, if nothing else, they ought to be angry that they're being used so transparently.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I totally agree. And this is something I've found come up again and again as I've paid attention to what Rufo is doing and how explicit he is. I get this persistent sense that Rufo just has absolutely no respect for the intelligence of his audience. That he will openly lie to them, but it's okay as long as he tells them that he's going to be lying to them or something to that effect. And I think that I've come to think about it a little bit differently. I see it as something that I think is key to fascist politics, which is this sense of willingful this willingness to participate in lies to defame the enemy because it brings you together and reaffirms your status as a member of the in-group and one of the good people. Because anything, as you said, with Carl Schmitt's friend-enemy distinction, anything is justified to defeat the enemy, right? And it's not about any commitment to, abstract principles or respect for civil debate or anything like that. Rufo himself has come out as saying, that he doesn't believe in anything like academic freedom, that it's a myth, that in Florida, if the legislature has the votes to ban academics from studying racial inequality, then it's not a violation of academic freedom to pass a law that would prevent professors from doing that because the universities are funded by taxpayer dollars and the taxpayers, through their representatives, have every right to abolish the study of those sorts of things if they want to. I think one of the most illuminating instances of Rufo coming out into the open and explaining just how much he doesn't care about telling the truth when it comes to his enemies comes when he did a thread about the language he recommends people use when talking about drag queens. So relevant to the Sarab Amari piece. This is especially worrying to me because as you said earlier, in your time in the 90s, right, mainstream American culture was vastly more homophobic. I've witnessed a pretty massive change over the course of my lifetime in how tolerant people are of LGBTQ identities. And something I've experienced a bit more firsthand because I have two moms. They're lesbian. And I remember in middle school when California, one of the most progressive states on this thing, in 2008 passed Proposition 8, which made it illegal for gay couples to be married. And I remember having people I was friends with at school, I brought it up to them and I was like, isn't this messed up? And, you know, people that I was close friends with saying, actually, I'm pretty sure that, you know, being gay is a sin, like your moms might be going to hell, like this sort of stuff. And it was a lot more common back then. And I thought just up until, you know, pretty much this past year that we had made progress that I naively saw as pretty set in stone. But the critical race theory panic paved the way for the grooming panic. And all of these issues about forbidden material in schools, explicit material in schools, very much set the stage, the CRT panic set the stage for the issue to shift to teaching about LGBTQ issues in schools and, you know, the presence of any transgender persons whatsoever is seen as a threat to, you know, children's innocence. That's another thing that it connects the two issues, is there's this overwhelming concern for the innocence of white children in the CRT case and what is seen as straight by default children in the grooming case and cisgender children in the grooming case. What Rufo said about the language in June of this year, he wrote, "Conservatives should start using the phrase trans stripper in lieu of drag queen. It has a more lurid set of connotations and shifts the debate to sexualization. Drag queens in schools invites a debate. Trans strippers in schools anchors an unstoppable argument." Then he says, "Let the left try to nitpick the phrase. We can say that trans is a stand-in for transvestite," which is a term that literally means cross-dresser, someone who dresses the opposite as their gender or sex. And he says, "We can show videos that are undeniably strip shows." He says, "The blackface for women argument is the wrong approach because it adopts the frame of the left, which traps conservatives in their identity games," which I thought was very amusing, that he's arguing that people shouldn't characterize drag queens as doing blackface for women because they shouldn't argue that blackface is bad. And then he says that saying it's blackface for women misses the main problem, which is the grotesque sexualization of children, right? Back to the innocence issue. And then he says, "Trans strippers in schools is a powerful frame to this debate. And if the left chooses to engage in language games on that phrase, they will find themselves defending concepts and words that are deeply disturbing to most people. Let them get stuck in the linguistic mud." Andrew Sullivan, who is usually team anti-woke, took issue with what Rufo said here. And he said, "Chris Rufo says that British parents who take their kids to pantomimes, where a drag queen is always one of the stars, are taking their kids to see trans strippers. The post-truth right has truly arrived." And Rufo's response is, "We shouldn't use euphemisms. This is a male-to-female transvestite strip show with children in attendance," right? Taking one of those videos where children are present at a drag queen event that involves some stripping, and that one event serves to solidify his entire linguistic manipulation. And again, as you said, it's very concerning that people just don't seem to care. And the only way I can explain it now is that they actually enjoy participating in this kind of defamation of their opponents.
So then to close out our conversation, what can we, as people who are very much worried about this direction that things are taking, what can we do about it, particularly given, you know, several episodes ago on the show, I had on Matt McManus to talk about the postmodern right and the way that the right, which is very much what you were just describing, has kind of embraced this postmodern approach to truth, that it's all narrative, we can manipulate the narrative, there's no point in trying to tie it to underlying principles or really much of anything, consistency doesn't matter in this view, and so on. What do we do about that? Because it seems like arguing against it just traps us in either kind of normalizing some of these views by like taking them seriously in the same way that you don't necessarily like debate the young earth creationists, or it enables them to play the sorts of games that Rufo, that you just described Rufo articulating. Like, how do we push back on something that is both so kind of corrosive and immoral from a social standpoint, but also just so detached from basic principles of like argumentation and what we took to be healthy political discourse?
Yeah. So a lot of people who are more involved than I am, I mean, I consider myself, I would deeply identify with the label anti-fascist, but I have not participated in Antifa protests myself. But I have spoken with people who are more involved in that sort of movement, countering fascistic political movements and things like right-wing militias and all those groups. And they often say that, you know, you cannot out-debate fascism. You can only smash fascism. Now, some people hear that and they think, okay, we should go murder Nazis and those sorts of things. Now, that's not what I'm saying. I don't think that, at least now, I mean, I think, for instance, if we were in another situation and there was a world war and there was Nazi Germany again, do I think that we should not intervene? That's not what I'm saying. I think that there is a time and place for warfare, and it's not to start wars, but to respond and to intervene when that's required for saving the lives of innocent people. But in terms of domestic issues, I do think it's true that you can't out-debate a fascist. I think that depending on the context, it could be worthwhile to debate specific fascists. For instance, I would be confident in my ability to debate someone like Chris Rufo, and I have invited him to do so multiple times, and he has blocked me on Twitter. And if anybody shares my article going into detail about how often he lies in his reporting on so-called critical race theory in schools, he'll block you too if you put it in his mentions. It's very important to him to preserve the epistemic bubble, the echo chamber that he has. But I think that one of the ways in which ordinary people can get bogged down is to hyper-focus on debunkings of specific claims. If you focus always on debunking specific claims, you'll never finish, because there will always be more claims that you have to debunk. And every time you debunk one claim about, say, a right-wing media story that has been proven to be based on false premises or bad reporting or whatever, there'll always be another one that someone can refer to. That will never change their mind. And it's very tempting to get caught up in the game of just, you know, refuting all these individual cases. What I think is much more powerful is to construct to be able to tell a story about what the right is doing, to be able to to be able to connect the dots for people on things that they might not have thought about themselves, to be able to connect, you know, tax breaks for the uber rich with the kinds of policies that are dominating Republican platforms, so that the debate isn't focused on how unpopular their economic proposals are, right? They have to keep us fighting about critical race theory in schools, about grooming in schools, so that the topic of debate isn't, you know, the fact that the right is absolutely opposed to improving healthcare for ordinary working class Americans, that they're actually opposed to the institution of public education itself. Part of the, you know, some of the, I would argue probably the primary long-term goal of both of the more critical race theory in schools, moral panics, and grooming in schools, moral panics, those are both about privatizing public education, which itself is not a popular policy for most Americans. Most Americans do want it to be the case that they can send their children to a school where they can get a quality education and not have to pay any money on top of the taxes that they're already paying. But because it's not popular to just say that we want to privatize public education, they have to, as Rufo put it himself, they have to operate from a premise of universal public school distrust to get to universal school choice. So I think what we have to be able to do is to point out to people how they are being deceived. Because I think for a lot of liberals, there is a temptation to buy into these moral panics, right? They're moral panics for a reason. People are panicking about these things because if they were true as they're being presented, they would be incredibly worthy of panic, right? If it were true that at schools across the United States, all the white children were being told that they're oppressors and that they should be ashamed of themselves, that'd be a pretty bad thing. If it were true that teachers were actually grooming students sexually to be exploited later on, that would be heinous. That would be a crime of massive proportions, right? So the temptation for these people is always going to be there. And the way to debunk the myth is not to constantly refute individual cases, but to be able to tell a story that connects the dots for people as to why they are being manipulated in the ways that they are. I think that is the only way that we will really be able to defeat this on a democratic level. There has to be people reaching out to the people that they're close with in real life. There are going to be a lot of uncomfortable conversations with people. That is one of the main reasons the CRT issue has taken hold so strongly, I think, is that a lot of white people, but also people of other races, do not want to have uncomfortable conversations with maybe older members of their family for fear of not wanting to point out that something that they said is racist, or that actually, you know, we don't use that kind of outdated terminology anymore, or any of those things. I mean, a lot of one-on-one conversations are going to happen, but I think a lot of the responsibility resides with people much higher up than ourselves in media institutions. I think there's a huge danger of prioritizing profit over the stability of a democratic republic. And so if there are many more stories that can be pumped out, and whatever gets the most clicks, if that is always going to determine what stories are told, then we might be doomed. But I don't think that we're doomed yet. And I think that there's a huge responsibility on the people in the media to be able to connect these dots for people in a way that is digestible and in a way that can get across to people without them having to, you know, read a 6-volume study. So, yeah, I'm not extraordinarily hopeful, but I am not totally in despair either.
Thank you for listening to Reimagining Liberty. This show is listener supported. If you'd like to become a member, gain access to our Discord community, and listen to every new episode 2 weeks before its public release, look for the link in the show notes or head to reimaginingliberty.com/subscribe.